believe before Mr. Corbett Bryant and Mr. Kevin Cook will present argument for the position of Mr. Bryant and Logan.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am here on behalf of the petitioner Juliet Fowler Holmes, which is a charitable institution up in Dallas. We are here because of a judgment which was entered against my client and also against the other petitioners in this matter. I'm here and would submit to the court that there has been error in the judgment that's been entered. The factual basis of this is fairly simply put. My client was engaging in a fundraising campaign, a special campaign to raise funds for an additional building program. In that connection, my client contracted an express written contract with the respondent here, Welch Associates. Welch Associates was to provide personnel for this particular campaign, or part of the personnel. Pursuant to that contract, Welch Associates then proceeded to engage and enter into an express written contract with another corporation, the John W. Butler Companies, Inc., under which, and under the terms of which, the Butler Company, Inc. would provide an individual. It was not specified in that contract which individual it would be, but an individual would be furnished to fill in one of the positions that was required to be provided by Welch Associates. Now, the heart of this matter arises from a restrictive covenant that is in that second contract, that's in the Welch Associates Butler Company's contract. I say that because the judgment below against my client was for tortious interference. The assertion by Welch Associates being that when my client chose to exercise its right under its contract to terminate the Welch Associates contract on 60 days written notice, which was expressly set forth in that agreement, at that time or thereafter, my client, or actually not my client, the National Benevolent Association, an umbrella-related organization, hired Mr. John Butler, who was the president of Butler Associates, to come and take a position of Director of Development. Now, that was a position that had existed long before this Fowler Fund, this campaign had gone on. But he was hired to take that position. Welch Associates asserts that that hiring by NBA to work there at Julie Fowler Homes constitutes a tortious interference between the other contract between those parties. Now, we would show this court that, in fact, that restrictive covenant is totally unenforceable and cannot be the basis, in addition, cannot be the basis of any tortious interference claim against my client. I would ask the court to keep in mind several important points before I move into analyzing this question of common calling and some of the other questions here. The Welch Associates contract with the Butler Companies was drafted by Welch Associates, by Byron Welch. And of course, I don't have to remind the court of the basic contract rules that you construe most strictly against the maker or drafter of a contract, a clause where there's any question at all about it. And of course, that's particularly true when you're talking about a restrictive covenant, which is looked upon with disfavor in the law in any event. Also, I assert and would submit to this court that what we see here by Welch Associates is truly unprecedented in Texas law. Welch Associates is attempting to impose a restrictive covenant not on an employee or an ex-employee, but upon the employees of a subcontracting company, which is totally unrelated to it. John Butler was never an employee of Welch Associates. In fact, we'll look at the restrictive covenant here in just a second, but it purports to restrain all of the employees, or they claim that it restrains all the employees of the John W. Butler Companies, Inc. And I would submit to the court, I sure can't find any case where that's even been attempted, much less was successful. And certainly the justifications that sometimes exist for restraining an employee of a company basically could probably never exist when you're talking about the employees of a subcontracting company that contracted for performance of one particular job. Now, in this instance, of course, I would direct the court's attention. I know the court has addressed common calling a number of times in this last year. The most recent case, I believe, is the Martin case, Martin versus Credit Protective Association. In that case, this court, in the opinion, again stated that there are only two times that a restrictive covenant will be enforced. One, incident to the sale of a business. That doesn't apply here, of course. And then secondly, post-employment covenants to prevent utilizing special training or knowledge. Well, in this instance, as I pointed out, we're not even talking about an employee, but even if that could be applicable to employees of a subcontractor, there was absolutely no special training or knowledge imparted to John Butler when he was performing his job by virtue of the subcontract, when he was on the premises at Juliet Fowler Homes. On the contrary, Welch asserted at trial, Byron Welch asserted at trial that the reason he entered into this contract, the subcontract, was because John Butler was already experienced and could step right in. And in fact, that's the case. The testimony was John Butler had a dozen or more years of experience in this general field, and he stepped back right in. He didn't get any training or experience at all from Welch Associates or Byron Welch. And of course, one common thread through all of these cases addressing restrictive covenants is you don't want to take away the ability of somebody who already has his own expertise or already has his own body of knowledge and training. You don't want to clamp him down from free movement in the marketplace and trying to get a job and make use of that. So here, the two instances where the Martin case says that you can restrain someone, neither one of them exists as a matter of law in the facts of this case. And of course, in the DeSantis case, this court commented on the fact that there Mr. DeSantis already had 14 years of experience in doing the job that he was doing. So that's something that has come up before. Now let me specifically address this question of common calling. I'm going to stand here and submit to this court that this is going to be the easiest case you'll have to decide this year. And I say that for this reason. When you look at the restrictive covenant in this case, what does it say it is restraining someone? On its face, it really says the John W. Butler Company, Inc. It doesn't say anything about John Butler. But ignoring that for the moment, it says it is restraining the John W. Butler Company, Inc. from what? From entering into any contract for any services with any past or present client of Welch Associates. Any contract for any services. It doesn't say John Butler is restrained from engaging in fundraising activities. It doesn't say John Butler is to be prevented from doing what he was doing under the subcontractor. It says his company, and they say him individually, can't enter into any contract for any services. In other words, on its face, it says that the Butler companies or its employees or whatever can't enter into a contract with Juliet Fowler Homes or the National Benevolent Association to go out and perform janitorial services if the Butler companies started in that line of work, or to go out and furnish yard services, to mow yards or whatever. By definition, this contract covers all common callings, any services that anyone would do. It's difficult for me to imagine how you could draft a restrictive covenant that would be more overbroad, that would be worse and more offensive under Texas law than this particular one. It was not narrowly drafted. It was drafted by Byron Welch. He bit off too much. He tried to do too much, and under Texas law, it simply isn't enforceable. Now, with regard to the question of fundraising itself, the Court of Appeals opinion totally ignored the language of this. It totally ignored the fact that it purported to restrict all services. The Court of Appeals opinion address the question of fundraising. I'm happy to talk about that too, because again, I'll submit to the court that even if you ignore the express language and say, well, all he's really trying to do was to restrict fundraising activities are common callings. You know, we go home at night, the phone rings, and someone from the JC's raising funds for someone. We step around to answer the door, and there's someone from the Girl Scouts or the band or from a soccer team asking to raise funds. We open up our mail and there's something from Boys Town, or there's something from the Democratic Committee or the Republican Committee. I would submit to this court that it's a very common calling. For better or for worse, fundraising is a very common calling.
If you just be at my home at night to answer the phone, you'd know that fundraising is a very, very common calling.
I think that's a common experience, Your Honor. In addition, of course, when we're talking about fundraising here, what really is fundraising? It's somebody being a salesman. In this instance, John Butler had experience, and I'm sure he was a good salesman. That's what he was. He was a salesman. And, of course, court said in the Martin case very expressly, talking about a man who had the title of director of marketing and who was vice president, and this court cut through all that and said he is and he was a salesman. And a salesman is a common calling. Somebody can be the greatest salesman in the world. He may get on television and jump around and do all kinds of things, but a salesman is a salesman. And I would submit to this court that, in fact, of course, here John Butler had no position or title with Welch Associates. He didn't have any, he wasn't in their office doing all the different things in their office. Instead, he had a title in this campaign, but that was over Juliet Fowler. He was given a title. Byron Welch made up a bunch of lofty-sounding titles to stick in his contract. The number two position in there was the senior resident campaign director, and that was the title that was slapped on the person who wound up being John Butler. So I would submit to the court that even if you look at labels, Still, that doesn't make any difference, and this court has had no problem with that. In the Bergman case, it was the manager of the salon. Didn't make any difference. He was a barber or hairstylist. What difference does it make what title you slap on somebody? Now, in this particular case, too, of course, fundraising. Fundraising doesn't have any educational requirements. It doesn't have any licensing requirements. State of Texas doesn't regulate it or supervise it. There aren't any standards applied. And in fact, when we got to the trial, they tried very hard to say, oh, this is really a profession. It's very lofty. Well, there aren't any standards, but there's a national organization. But when I asked at the trial, and you'll see in the record, well, who can join the organization? Anybody can join their national organization. They may be attempting to create some standards or develop some professionalism, but anybody can join the organization. So fundraising, and it's salesmanship. And
is
I will,
it your contention then that unless it is a recognized profession, that is the common calling?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. And as this court has said, you address each question on the facts of that case to decide whether or not it's a common calling. I have a hard time thinking of it. Maybe there's some kind of fundraising under some special circumstances that is not a common calling, where someone needs a special language of some sort to call on someone, or someone has to be trained in a certain way to call on someone. But certainly in this instance, when you're talking about calling on people and asking them to contribute to a charitable organization in Dallas that provides services for the elderly and youth services and all that, to call on people and say, please contribute money to this worthy organization.
Does the degree of expertise have anything to do with common calling?
I think you have to consider the degree of expertise.
Well, could you be an expert fundraiser and of such talent and demonstrability that you would be sought after by fundraising groups and your employment something that you could charge a great deal of money for?
I have difficulty imagining that particular occupation rising to the level of where this court would say it is not a common calling. I have
the training that is imparted, or special knowledge you learn, a more salient factor that we would look at under Hill and Bergman than just whether or not you have native talent that you would bring to the job.
I agree with that, and the question is the training that's been imparted by the promisee. And here there was zero training imparted by Welch Associates. This court has always said if a person comes into that position and already has a body of knowledge and a body of experience, we take great pains not to restrict that.
But if Welch and Associates sought out someone of a demonstrated talent and ability, you don't think that they would have the right to restrict that person from a competition in their contract with them?
At most, if they were restricting them from the private confidential information that was imparted to them, that arguably could take place. Let me point out to the court that the contract between these two companies did not say that they were seeking out John Butler or that John Butler had to play that role. It said that John Butler Companies, Inc. would provide a person. It had to be a person acceptable to Juliet Fowler Holmes, it said in the contract. They have argued that, I really meant this to be with John Butler. They could have said that in the contract, and they didn't do that. And in answer to your question, I would submit that if you're talking about fundraising, I have a hard time seeing how that could ever be anything other than a common call.
And well, now, there's some difference of opinion about whether or not John Butler, the company, and John Butler, the person, are indistinguishable.
Your Honor, they pled alter ego and lost on that at trial and did not pursue it on appeal. So that's been taken care of. I would submit to the court, too, that, again, keeping in mind restrictive covenants are strictly construed. There are plenty of cases that say you do not, by implication, extend the range of it. And let me point out that in this very sentence, the first half of that sentence before the semicolon says the employees of the company agree not to divulge confidential information. Byron Welch knew how to draft it when he meant to include the employees. After the semicolon, it says, the restricted covenant part says, the John W. Butler Companies, Inc. will not enter into a contract, so on and so forth. He knew how to do it in that very sentence. He tried to do it as to the employees in the first part of it and expressly did it in the second half. I would submit to this court, when you're thinking about common calling, that all of us here could do a lot better job and could a lot more easily go out tomorrow and engage in this very activity, fundraising, and be a lot more successful than if we went out tomorrow and tried to be a barber or if we went out and tried to do auto trim and the other instances that this court has said were common calling. I'm sure John Butler could do a better job of it than I could, and maybe some or all of y'all could. But we'd come a lot closer to hitting the mark by going out there and using salesmanship to try to raise money for a worthy organization than if we went in and tried to cut hair and or style hair. And I would submit to this court that we've got a clear common calling here, and we've got the whole realm of common callings are encompassed by the way this was drafted. And I submit to the court that this is clearly an unenforceable clause that we have. Now, in addition, and the court is right that the Court of Appeals said considerable expertise was required here. There really wasn't any proof of that in the record. But totally apart from that, if we simply say that when someone gets experience, someone could be out there trimming yards for years and years and could be the best yard cutter in the world. And somebody may seek out the best yard cutter in the world specifically because they've got multi-million dollar palatial estate and they want to cut the best possible. But that is a common calling. A salesman is a salesman is a salesman, I would submit to the court. Now, with regard to this particular restrictive covenant, this restrictive covenant is riddled with defects. And I would simply ask the court to look at the language of it. This isn't very good, this small version we have over here. But let me just tick off a couple of problems with it. Number one, of course, I've already pointed out it says any services. Number two, there isn't any geographic restriction. Court of Appeals kind of blew by that, too. Number three, it says directly or indirectly perform services. You could violate this without even knowing it. Fourth,
is it your contention that any covenant would have to have a geographic limitation?
That's what the cases have said, Your Honor.
Well, nationwide, is that's always too broad?
No, it may not be, but here they didn't say nationwide. And the record showed that Welch Associates had been doing business for 25 years with people all over the United States.
But you could not have a worldwide limitation?
On some facts, that might be reasonable.
Well, then if you got a worldwide limitation, then you're not talking about geographic limitations, are you?
Well, Your Honors, I read all the cases. The cases say you have to say some geographic restriction. Then the court looks and sees, is that reasonable?
But if it said worldwide, would that have been a geographic limitation?
If it said worldwide, that would have been an attempted geographic limitation, which on these facts would have been unreasonable. But we can't even get to address unreasonableness when they have no limitation at all. Prima facie, it's unreasonable. If they have no geographic limitation, this court has never, to my knowledge, upheld a restrictive covenant that had no geographic limitation. And the Court of Appeals said, well, we don't really need that if they name the people. They didn't name. They said all of the past, and that's another point I was going to make here, it said this is restricting all of the present or past clients. And that list is everybody they've been doing business with for 25 years. There certainly isn't any need to protect Welch Associates by saying that if they subcontract with one company on one job, that precludes those people from ever doing any business directly or indirectly with anybody that Welch Associates ever did business with before. And there's testimony he did business with people in California, movie industry out there. He did business in Wisconsin, Missouri, all over the country for 25 years. And that on its face is overbroad and impermissible. In addition, this purports to restrain, on its face it just says the company, but they claim it applies to all the employees of the Butler companies. What employees? The employees when this agreement was signed in 1981, the employees who at any time during the course of the three-year period were working there, the employees of the Butler companies in the 2 years that this purports to restrain activity afterwards. Does this restrain employees who never even heard about this contract? I would submit to the court that the defects in this particular restriction mount and mount. Of course, it says with the company only, so there's the problem with that. I've already referred to the direct and indirect, past and present clients. This simply won't stand up. Let me emphasize two other things to this court. The trial judge did not enforce that restriction. This restriction says you can't enter into a contract with somebody else. John Butler is working in the same position right now. The trial judge didn't enforce this. Instead, his injunction that he entered said you can't use donor lists that were given. There wasn't any evidence that any donor information was given, in fact, used, so there was no support for that. In the Court of Appeals brief, Mr. Zukowski agreed that the injunction actually entered by this trial judge had no basis in the record, was not enforceable. He didn't stand behind it. The trial judge wouldn't even enforce this. If it's not enforceable as an injunction, then under the law, it can't be the basis for money damages against the Butler companies or John Butler. And under the cases, and really it's two Fifth Circuit cases that have really addressed it.
Why not? I mean, let's assume there was no contract at all. Why couldn't you have tortious interference with a business relationship, even absent a contract between Butler and Company and Welch?
Because if this court has, as it always said, you encourage free movement of people generally, then you're stepping back even one more step and saying the person who hires that person is supposed to be at risk, even though the person who moves can't be at risk. That would have a chilling effect on the person who's trying to move just as much as saying that the person who was moving was going to be restrained or have a money judgment against him. And this whole body of law, the body of law says we just don't allow this to happen except in two specific instances.
I'm well familiar with Bill and Burton.
Okay.
But you're saying that because of the nature of the conduct that the allegation of interference exists, that there can, as a matter of law, can be no tortious interference. Is that what you're saying?
As a matter of law, because, yes, that they've sued saying tortious interference with this particular clause. And if the clause doesn't stand up, then it must fail. And this court has said, of course, going back to Weatherford, too, if it's unenforceable, there can't be a money judgment. And then, as I say, the Fifth Circuit case is most directly addressed the fact. Of course, they argue that the Clements case says that you can still have tortious interference. That was a statute of frauds. All the public policy reasons here say that you can't have tortious interference. The director of development was not the same position as what he had been doing before, and I want to make sure the court understands that. The director of development post had been there long before this and has different functions. There's some overlap. But the director of development is in charge of annual fund and public relations and other written materials and other things like that. So I wanted to make sure the court was aware of that. The court has said that there are fundamental policies involved in this area. This court has, in making the choice of law decision in DeSantis, said we're not going to enforce a specific provision here that says Florida law applies because Texas law is so important in this area. And I submit to the court that because of that, this judgment must be reversed and rendered. The balance of the time that we have, Mr. Cook is going to address several of the other points, unless the court has another question of me right now.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Cook. I represent petitioners John Butler and the John W. Butler Company. And I'm going to address two issues, one of which Mr. Bryan has touched on. That is, did the Court of Appeals err in extending this invalid non-compete provision to John Butler individually? And second, which I think touches more on the question Justice Kilgarland raised, is whether John Butler could tortiously interfere with the Juliet Fowler Holmes Welch Associates contract when that contract was terminated by notice pursuant to its express notice provisions. I think that goes with the question is whether or not you can tortiously interfere with that type of contract or a contract terminable at will. As Mr. Bryant has explained, the Court of Appeals said that this non-compete provision here bound Mr. Butler individually. I think it's important to note, of course, that the language of the provision itself only applies to Butler Company. The contracting party to the contract is Butler Company. The signing party to the contract is Butler Company, signed by John Butler, but in his capacity as president of the corporation Butler Company. Now, it was not Butler Company that was hired by the National Benevolent Association. It was John Butler individually. As Mr. Bryan has explained, you simply cannot, by inference or implication, extend this provision to John Butler individually. You have to strictly construe the provision against its author, and here that's Welch Associates. I think what the Court of Appeals here did is made the erroneous assumption that the record showed that John Butler was the only employee of Butler Companies, and the record simply does not show that. The record does not tell you whether or not the Butler Companies has one employee or 1,000 employees. In fact, the only thing in the record that tells you whether there's one or more than one is the agreement itself, which says employees. Uses a plural term. I think what's the importance of that is simply that if you don't know how many employees the company has, there's no reason to distinguish the John W. Butler Companies from Ford or General Motors or IBM or any other corporation. I think the Court of Appeals erred in using that reason. We believe that the record in this case shows that there's no evidence that Butler or Butler Companies tortiously interfered with the Juliet Fowler Homes Wealth Associates fundraising contract. However, there's a simpler reason for the court to reverse and render this case without addressing that issue. And that's simply that you can't tortiously interfere with a contract terminated pursuant to its expressed bargain for notice provision. The Juliet Fowler Homes Wealth Associates contract was terminable without cause upon 60 days notice. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Juliet Fowler Homes gave 60 days notice of terminating the contract. You can't tortiously interfere when you convince someone to exercise their contracted for and bargained for rights. Juliet Fowler Homes didn't do anything wrongful or unlawful in terminating their contract. They didn't breach it. What they did is they exercised their bargain for contractual rights. Now, the Court of Appeals disagreed with this argument, and it relied primarily on two cases, the Fifth Circuit DeVille case and the Champion v. Wright case. And these cases reasoned that, well, the law protects tortious interference with prospective business relationships. So it protects something that's less complete than a contract terminable upon notice. And the law protects contracts on the other end of the spectrum. The law protects contracts that are term contracts that aren't terminable pursuant to a notice provision. Therefore, if you're protecting both ends of the spectrum, you have to protect what's in the middle. Otherwise, it's inconsistent. And I think that reasoning is wrong. And the reason is simple. When you have a term contract, you bargain for that term. You bargain for the right to have that contract not terminated earlier. When you're protecting a prospective business relationship, what you're protecting is the ability of the parties to make a bargain. You're protecting their negotiating process so they can set up a bargain and a contract without interference. But when you have a contract that's terminable upon notice and it's terminated pursuant to its notice provision, you aren't doing either thing. You aren't asking a party to act inconsistently with what they bargained for. You aren't interfering with their bargain. You're asking one party to act consistently with the deal that they made. Simply, if a party wants to protect itself against somebody coming in and inducing or asking somebody to terminate a contract, which, again, we don't believe the record shows there's any evidence that Butler or Butler Companies did that anyway. But if you want to prevent that from happening, you pay for that right when you make your contract. You have a term contract that's not terminable upon any notice or set notice period. Now, what the Court of Appeals did here is said, no, that's not the rule. The rule is that you can come in and induce them to terminate upon notice, but only if you have legitimate business purpose. And here, there isn't legitimate business purpose because by doing that, Butler violated that non-compete provision. Well, the problem with that argument simply is the non-compete provision, as Mr. Bryant has argued, is not any good under Texas law. It's void and unenforceable. And the second reason is that even if it's valid, it's not binding on John Butler individually. He's not a party to it. That primarily, I think, provides the court with the reason to reverse and render the judgment of the Court of Appeals. Any questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please the court, Mr. John Zukowski will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning. My name is John Zukowski. I represent Welch Associates, Inc. They are respondent. They have a petition also on 2 points. I also represented them in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals. Before responding to some of the specific points raised this morning, I want to make sure that what I believe are certain salient factual points are highlighted. The first point I think that has to be highlighted is the actual fundraising campaign we're talking about here. And this is a campaign that cannot be minimized as it is attempted to be done by talking about Girl Scout solicitation and phone calls at night. This was a campaign to raise $10 million. It was to extend over 3.5 years, for which Welch Associates was to receive almost $1 million in fees and expenses. It was a regional campaign to extend over the entire Southwest, and it involved the isolation and solicitation of thousands of donors. In sum, it was a massive undertaking. There is also one very important point that I need to emphasize to the court. There is a mischaracterization of exactly what is being done here. The testimony at trial was very clear. Welch Associates, Inc. was never going to solicit $1 of funds. That was not their function. Their function, and it was testified to at trial, was that they put together a plan. They put together the infrastructure to implement that plan, and then they managed the fundraising campaign. It was up to Juliet Fowler Holmes to put the people in place, through volunteers and other people, to actually go out and solicit the funds. So we're talking about something very different from going door to door to raise funds. We're talking about a massive professional undertaking, a campaign that was planned.
Different from a sales campaign?
It depends on what structure you're talking about. If you're talking about the salesman.
Does, I'm talking about its basic elements.
No, sir. It just depends on what your role is in that sales campaign. If you are the salesman, that is not what Welch Associates was doing. If you are the person planning the ad exec, planning the campaign, then yes, that is what Welch Associates was doing.
What about an advertising account?
It's the role, I'm making the distinction based on what your role is in that. They are analogous to the ad campaign manager, the person who actually puts together, comes up with the plan, tells the client how to put it together, but it's the client who actually goes out and pays and puts the people in place to do it.
If a salesperson or even a sales manager is not a common calling, then what is? What about a mechanic?
A mechanic, the court has said, is. I think you could argue that a salesperson is a common calling.
But I make... A sales manager is not.
No. If he has the expertise to manage an area, to manage the people involved, per se, he's no longer selling.
What about a personnel manager?
I don't think that's a common call.
What about a manager of security guard?
Again, I don't necessarily think that is a common call. I think the common calling, if I understand the court, is the actual going out and doing of that kind of a job.
What about the manager of a barber, a hairstyling shop?
Again, if it takes special expertise to run that shop, I don't believe that should be a common
special
calling.
Special expertise to be a mechanic.
But, again...
Can you use that as a distinguishing factor? What I'm looking for from you is some kind of a definition of a common calling that's useful.
What I think it is, I don't think it's more... you have to approach it of what a common calling isn't. Because as I understand, a common calling can be anything, so we're going to have to distinguish as to what it isn't, is what I see here, and that's what I'm trying to provide the court, is to say what a common calling isn't. And if it takes experience, if it takes training, if it is something that the common ordinary man can't do, then I don't think that can be considered a
that's
common
an
calling.
Mechanic.
Pardon?
That's an auto mechanic. You described an auto mechanic. Takes experience, takes training, something the ordinary man can't do.
I think I can go out and change my oil in my car, and that's where I have the problem. It's a differentiation of where you draw the line between someone who goes out and works on his car on the weekend. Is he a mechanic? Yes, he is.
Are there educational requirements?
Not necessarily.
Are you really asking this court counsel to change the law, to do away with Hill and Bergman and Blackenhut and the other cases that come down this past year?
I find it difficult to define common calling. The justice asked me to do that. I don't know if you can define what a common calling is. I think you have more success in defining what it is.
I'm suggesting to you that battle has been lost.
At least in a couple of cases. Yes.
Well,
let's get you off of common calling, because the court is well familiar with DeSantis versus Wackenhut and Bergman versus Norris of Houston, Hill versus Mobile Auto Trim. Let's talk about, irrespective of whether it's a common calling, can this contract stand from this point of its broadness? There is no limit, is there, on the nature, assuming that Butler individually is covered by the contract. There's no restriction as to time and place in the contract, is there?
I don't believe that's true for this reason. It's restricted to past and present clients.
which was something that was clearly defined at trial. Welch Associates stated under examination at trial who its past clients had been. That was not a difficult thing to ascertain. To me, that is a much more precise limitation than saying Dallas-Fort Worth or the state of Texas.
How long could he not contact these farmer clients?
2 years.
2 years.
2 years after the contract between Butler and Welch terminated.
For any endeavor?
No, I think that is a mischaracterization.
Well, that's what it said.
They're taking it out of context because you have to read the entire contract. This was a contract for management services for fundraising.
Where does it say that?
It says services in that paragraph.
Well, but where does it say fundraising services? Where is it limited to fundraising?
It again, you have to take the contract within its four corners. It is a managed, the contract is entitled Management Contract. The first paragraph is, this is a contract for management services of the Julia Fowler Homes campaign. And then it begins to talk about fundraising services. And that's where it's consistently stated and utilized. It is not a broad-based definition of services.
When you look at the restrictive covenant, that's what we're looking at. And I'm asking you, inviting me, give us your best shot. On number six here, where you have the restrictive covenant and the language that says that you will not enter into any form of contract or services directly or indirectly. And it seems to me it's open-ended. And I'm asking you to give us your best argument to respond to their argument they just made.
To say that it applies to nothing but to any services is to take the contract out of context. You don't isolate on just paragraph six. You have to read paragraph one through, I think there were some seven paragraphs and some introductory statements. And it's clear that what they're talking about are management services for a fundraising campaign. And to isolate on one paragraph is to take it out of context.
Well, how about the other argument that you drafted this contract, you have to live with it the way you drafted it. We have to, in fact, you're the indulge all presumptions against for them and against you.
We did not specifically draft this contract. The first draft was submitted by Welch Associates, Inc. You will find that even in the final contract, there are interlineations. This was a negotiated document. And to state that because the person who submits the first draft drafted the agreement, I think, is a mischaracterization. It was a negotiated document back and forth.
A few minutes ago, you said that Welch contracted with Fowler to manage the campaign, but the Fowler was to put the people in place?
Yes, sir.
But yet Welch contracted the Fowler?
Yes, but that was simply to put more management people in place. What I'm talking about is that Julia Fowler Homes...
the relationship between Welch and Butler, or between Butler and Fowler?
It was between Butler and Welch. But what I'm saying is, when I was talking about the fact that Julia Fowler had the obligation to put people in place, I'm talking about to do the actual solicitation, to actually go out and make the calls, to man the phones. Welch had the obligation to put the management people in place.
So Butler was a manager too?
Yes, sir. He was. He was the resident manager of the campaign. He was the person whose obligation it was to remain in Dallas and manage the campaign on a day-to-day basis in Dallas. And then he took his instructions. There were, I think there were twice monthly meetings between Mr. Butler and Mr. Welch in regard to how the campaign was going and seeing how the plan was to be followed. Important to note, there was a specific plan in place that was followed stating what was supposed to happen on certain terms. There was supposed to be a general overture, then they were going to go to specific, look at large donors, look at small donors, and this was all planned out. And that's what they were
implementing.
Yes, it was. It was incorporated into the contract between Welch Associates, Inc. and Julia Fowler Homes by specific reference in the contract. It states they were going to implement that particular plan. I think it was called the Fowler Fund Plan, is the way it's referred to in the contract. Maybe incorrect about the characterization, but the contract, or the plan, was specifically incorporated into the Welch Associates contract.
Do you claim that there are any esoteric techniques or special processes or information that is to be protected by this restricted
cabin? Other than client lists and certain know-how, no.
Client lists would vary, of course, between different kinds of fundraising activities, would it not?
Yes, and I'm mindful that the courts recently opined on client lists and those kind of lists, so I'm not really raising that. But what I really think is the know-how, is we're talking about. How do you put something like this in management?
Should that be the sort of thing you can protect by a restrictive covenant, the know-how? Isn't that applicable to a mechanic?
I think in this case, that is maybe the key why the restrictive covenant is so important, and you have to, again, understand. It was testified to a trial, and I don't think I can put it better, that the assets of the professional fundraiser go down the elevator at night. And what the man was talking about is it's the people who manage the campaign that is the true asset of the professional fundraiser. When they, it is a very common process for the professional fundraiser to put an on-campus or in-person person in place on a campaign, such as John Butler. That person then is the person who's in daily contact with the client. He establishes a special rapport. He establishes a special relationship. It is very easy for the client to go to that person and say, well, let's eliminate the fundraiser, let's eliminate this contract, and let me just hire you. That is something that happens quite often and was testified to at trial.
What's the difference in that and my going to the mechanic after the other case to see and hire him directly?
Because you don't,
I don't have to pay the agency if they go with him that way.
Well, for one thing, I don't know if the agency has a restrictive covenant, but it goes back to the fact
that... Hey, they do it by enforcement.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But it goes back to the fact, and it's something I was going to raise in emphasizing these facts, is there was a tremendous amount of testimony at trial, uncontroverted, that there is a special relationship created between a fundraiser and the client in a situation. Because of the fact that you put a person in place, most of the work is front-end work. You put together the plan, you put together the infrastructure, the people, and then the implementation can be done by many people once they know what to do and told how to do it.
Let's move on to another point, Dan.
What is Welch the nature of their business? Are they headhunters only in fundraising endeavors, or are they a general employment agency, or just what are they?
No, they are, and I think headhunters would be a mischaracterization. They are solely a professional fundraising organization. They've been in business for some 30 years, and their sole business is to go out, plan these kind of campaigns, in some instances plan them and actually implement them, as was done in this case.
They personally, or as a company, do no fundraising.
That's correct.
They merely find the people who are going to run the fundraising.
Yes, but I don't want to skip over the fact that they also put together this plan. It's really a twofold process, and I think that's important.
What about the point that the contract that your client entered into had a provision that the contract would be terminated without cause on 6 days' notice, and therefore your client was fired under that contract provision, and there can be no tortious interference because you were lawfully fired?
Well, I think that kind of begs the question. They seem to be saying there's a difference, change in the law in that. In tortious interference, there has to be a finding that the interference was not privileged. And I think that's what they're talking about, and I think that's what the recent Court of Appeals decisions have seized on, is that all contracts are entitled to the protection. Just because it's a terminable at will contract doesn't mean that it loses the protection of the law. The question becomes, was that interference privileged? And they're stating that by the fact that it could be terminable at will, it's obviously privileged. The jury didn't find that. And the fact of the matter, again, there's been a glossing in that all that's been emphasized here is this violation of the restrictive covenant. A couple of points. One, that was not the sole point relied upon in the pleading or the evidence. There was a lot of evidence, in fact, that Julie Fowler Holmes, through its executive director, Mr. Dowell, and John Butler had conspired to actively eliminate the need for Welch Associates, Inc. some year prior to the actual termination. They decided they were not going to follow the plan. They decided they were going to do things differently, and they decided they were going to eliminate Welch Associates, and that was testified to at trial. So it's just not interference with the restrictive covenant. It was interference with the complete implementation of the charge of a Welch associate. And that keeps being glossed by, but that was something that was very important at trial, in that one witness testified that there was a conspiracy, a plan, to eliminate Welch associates almost a year prior to his actual termination. So I don't want to just concentrate on the restrictive covenant. You don't need just the restrictive covenant in order to uphold the tortious interference in this situation. In regard to this clause, something else needs to be pointed out. First of all, contrary to what Mr. Bryant stated, there was no alter ego allegation in the petition. There was no submission of an alter ego question to the jury. It's not there. Instead, the position taken by Welch Associates is that this provision is ambiguous because, as the court will see, it begins by saying
the second part of that paragraph 6, the employees of the John Butler Company agree that. And then it goes on, and in fact, I'll represent to the court, it is ambiguous. That question was submitted to the jury, and the jury returned a finding that John Butler had personally and mutually agreed to be bound by this provision, and there's no better proof in the record than the fact that prior to formally accepting the position with Julia Fowler Holmes, he voluntarily and on his own sought a release, a personal release from Welch Associates in order to take the position. He obviously recognized the need. There was testimony at trial that, in fact, Julia Fowler Holmes also knew that the release applied to John Butler and advised him that, in fact, he was to obtain this release before they'd offer him the position. So the jury has found, the court decided it was ambiguous, it submitted the question to the jury, and the jury found that, in fact, John Butler had individually agreed to be bound by that provision. Again, I think that's an important point. I think probably I have addressed all of the points raised to some degree by counsel. I wanted to conclude simply by briefly stating a couple of points in regard to, I guess it's really not a cross petition, but the petition of Welch Associates in this matter. It's fairly simply brief. There were really only two points that were raised. One, the court did not award attorney fees against Julia Fowler Holmes and Butler individually. We think the record clearly shows, and in fact the jury found, there were breaches of contract by both of those entities. And as such, as a matter of law, the attorney fees must have been awarded. The Court of Appeals kind of went by that point by saying that the issue had been waived in that it was not preserved. It seemed to state that we needed to do something in the trial court other than asking for an award of attorney fees in the motion for judgment, which we did.
Successful to then be put in a position where they have to go and contest the judgment.
An issue of reasonableness and necessity of fees submitted?
Yes, it was, and there's a finding by the jury in regard to each one of these parties as to what the attorney fees should be. The attorney fees are there. So I did not want to pass that point. Those are the two points raised by Welch Associates. We think that an award of attorney fees should have been awarded against Butler and Julia Fowler Holmes. Does the court have any further questions?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
In the few minutes left, I want to point out to the court four or five points on which I very strenuously disagree with Mr. Zukowski as to what the record reflects, and I think they're important points because questions have been asked about them. Before I do that, let me just spend 30 seconds on the cross appeal here, their petition. The Court of Appeals correctly held that they had waived any claim for attorney's fees, and I think that's easily disposed of because, of course, the law says that he must bring to the trial court's attention any error in the judgment that's being entered. In fact, Mr. Zukowski's response to our motion for new trial on the first judgment to assign you, it was thereafter modified, he said in that the judgment as entered was correct, and that first judgment did not award attorney's fees against Julia Fowler Holmes. The second judgment modified certain things, including some really double dip on some damages. There were some modifications there. And again, there was nothing brought to the trial court's opinion after that or at any time thereafter that would have called to the trial court's attention at that point. So clearly it was waived at trial. The Court of Appeals just ruled on that issue. Even beyond the waiver point, as a matter of law, they can't get attorney's fees because the judgment wasn't signed based on breach of contract and couldn't be signed based on breach of contract. The right to terminate on 60 days written notice was clear in the contract. It was unambiguous, and we won on, and we were entitled to win on that point. The trial judge, in an abundance of caution, submitted two issues to the jury, 1 and 1A, in which he asked, was it the intent and agreement of the parties that my client could terminate only on a good faith basis, or was there any limitation on that? And the jury found, no, it could be terminated for any reason. And there's no dispute that mechanically it was done on the 60 days written notice. So I think that whether it's decided on the waiver point, as the Court of Appeals did, or ultimately on the merits of it, certainly there shouldn't be any attorney's fees against my client. The judgment against my client was on the tortious interference theory, and that's what I'm asking this court to address. Now, with regard to five specific fact points that I will assert to you that Mr. Zukowski is in error, He has attempted to emphasize, apparently realizing the problem of common calling, he tries to emphasize that Mr. Butler was instead a manager. In fact, the trial record is replete with the dispute that went on, or the complaint that Mr. Welch was making about Mr. Butler. What complaint? Mr. Butler wasn't in Dallas when Mr. Welch would come in and fly in and want to meet with him. Mr. Butler was out on the road soliciting funds, calling on donors. The characterization that he was sitting in Dallas as a manager is just not right. He did have some managerial responsibilities in coordinating some of the lay people who would go out and do that, but most of that scheduling was really handled by the clerical staff there. What he was doing primarily was going out on the road, and Mr. Welch even complained about some of his own employees scheduling John Butler out of town, calling on prospective donors too frequently, so that he wasn't available to talk to Mr. Welch when Mr. Welch decided to breeze into town and jump in there and wanted to meet with him. The characterization that he was just a manager is just flat wrong. And on the second point, I wanted to point out to you, of course, there was a lot of money involved. Welch Associates received over $600,000 as its fee, over in excess of $250,000 in reimbursement of expenses. But Julia Fowler contracted for and wanted a right. This is a three-year contract. They could have either done yearly contracts and then renewed them, or go ahead and, as they did, do a three-year contract with the ability to terminate. That was heavily negotiated. You can see where it was 60 days and then 30 days and then 60 days, 90 days, I think, at one time. That was something that was very important to Julia Fowler and was contracted so that they could, without being second-guessed on the reasonings, terminate it if they were dissatisfied. And they became dissatisfied with Byron Welch's performance. Secondly, they said, in response to the geographic problem, they said, well, everybody knew what all the past clients were. There was no evidence at trial, any list of all the past clients of Welch Associates. On cross-examination, I brought out the identity of four or five of the past clients to point out the geographic range and other problems that Welch had elsewhere. At the time this was signed, no list of past clients were given, and at no time to this very moment has Welch Associates given John Butler a list of past clients so he could know what he would be violating if he engaged in any other activity with somebody else. So that's simply not right either. Third, they want to imply that somewhere or another John Butler was put in this position at Julia Fowler where he develops a special relationship, and then that's something that ought to be protected. Julia Fowler Homes is well known in Dallas. John Butler was already familiar with that institution. It's a charitable institution. He was a member of the same church that this is related to. Everybody was aware of them and where they were and what they were, and he had already had contacts with them. I would simply point out to the court that this isn't a situation where some prospective client over here that nobody knew about, that they found somebody and put him in that role. Also, the court has asked this question about, does Welch Associates itself do any fundraising? The answer to that is yes. They implied up here that instead, Welch Associates goes out and finds the people and puts them in here. And on this particular matter, in this particular case, there were five people that were furnished by Welch Associates in connection with this campaign. Byron Welch, an employee of Welch Associates, who was the top man, who would come in and render this advice and do these things. The Butler Companies was contracted to put in the number two man, who turned out to be John Butler. That's the only non-Welch employee who was involved in this. There were three women, employees of Welch Associates, who were put on the campus of Julia Fowler Homes to do various things. Much of it clerical, but they would receive monies and handle all the things there in the office. So when the representation is made that Welch Associates does not engage in fundraising, four of the five people furnished here were employees of Welch Associates, three of whom were expressly put on the campus there at Julia Fowler Homes to engage in the fundraising. So that is just not accurate. Next, when they indicated that there's this talk about this plan of action, and Mr. Zukowski is correct in saying that the plan of action is referred to in the contract between his client and mine. But one thing that is apparently Mr. Welch has misunderstood and still doesn't understand is that plan of action does not give Welch Associates the right to insist that page by page the quote plan of action must be followed, that he, Mr. Byron Welch, has the right to insist that Julia Fowler call on donors in a specific order. He developed a plan and that's fine, but there was nothing that required that Julia Fowler had to go to the major donors first, or this person first, or that person first. They could exercise their own discretion, and that's why there was a falling out here. He had his ideas about the campaign. The people at Julia Fowler had their ideas about the campaign. They went on and on, and they went with him a long way and ultimately became so dissatisfied that they said, you know, we're going to terminate it now. We're going to exercise our right on 60 days' notice. They did that. There can't be a recovery for breach of contract. So they've tried to backdoor through this tortious interference claim, and that simply can't stand up because of this. I want to make sure that I haven't misrepresented to the court an alter ego. It is my recollection they did plead that at trial. They did not submit a special issue on it. That is accurate. And that was because there was no way, they had no proof of anything like that. They didn't come in and show any commingling of funds or anything like that. So I would submit to the court that, in fact, there is no reason here to affirm the judgment below. The Court of Appeals simply didn't apply the law on common calling, simply didn't look at the real terms of this contract. And as I previously pointed out to the court, the trial judge didn't either. The trial judge tried to come up with some kind of injunction, but it has no basis in fact here. And if the trial judge wouldn't even enforce this injunction, I think that speaks loudly. And as I pointed out in the Court of Appeals brief, and I didn't hear Mr. Zukowski come up here, and again, I would suggest that you listen and see when he comes back up here. Is he going to say to you that the injunction that was entered by the trial judge is proper, accurate, or should continue to be upheld by this court, or can it be the basis for any tortious interference? Thank you very much.
That concludes the argument in the first case. We'll take a brief
May it please the court, we'll have a brief reply.
Certainly.
I got one issue that didn't take more than a couple minutes.
Better be good.
Helps up. Now, there's one thing that Mr. Zukowski put in their reply to application for writ of error, and his argument today simply that confuses me. And that's that he's admitted that this non-compete provision is ambiguous. Well, its non-compete provisions basically are not favored in the law. They're against public policy. They shouldn't be overbroad. They are strictly construed, and they stand or fall on their face under the Weatherford Tool case. And if he's admitted it's ambiguous, he's admitted that it's got to fall on its face as written. I think on that basis alone, he's admitted that this non-compete provision cannot be enforced and can't be the subject of money damages, which is exactly what the trial court did. Thank you.
All right. That concludes the argument.